Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Yeah, but every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Hey, greetings, my friends. A lot of the news today. Bush and Cheney are gushing about General Casey, although it looks like he's going to be their next Iraq scapegoat. And Massachusetts lawmakers are debating whether or not to end gay marriage in that state with a constitutional amendment. John Shalikashvili is saying, enough already with don't ask, don't tell. The FBI is reporting that at Guantanamo, we've been duct taping and baptizing prisoners, duct taping their mouths shut. Net neutrality, we thought that monster was dead. It looks like it may arise again, the end of net neutrality, the attempt to destroy net neutrality may arise again in Congress. House Republicans are pushing the minority bill of rights that Nancy Pelosi proposed 2 years ago and Denny Hastert didn't bother to answer. And Pat Robertson has been talking to God again. We'll get into all of that stuff a little later on in the program. Right now, I want to revisit a topic we touched on lightly yesterday and really get into it. This whole issue of how do we take back our government? How do we make a government that works in the United States? And John Samples is with us. He's the director of the Cato Institute's Center for Representative Government, cato.org, their website. John Samples, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
John, it seems to me that the solution to the problem that we have of increasing quantities of money buying increasing political favors leading to, I think what we both agree is disastrous government spending. I'm certainly would disagree on exactly where those disasters are occurring, but nonetheless, we probably agree on this. It seems to me the thing to do is to roll back the Buckley case and say, sorry, no money is not free speech, and put into place some very specific limits on spending like they have in the United Kingdom. In the United Kingdom, you can't spend more than $100,000 if you're running for a seat in the House of Commons, period. And so campaigns only last a few weeks.
Well, that's right, but I don't think that's a good idea because I think it's beyond doubt that money in all of its forms, either as contribution and certainly as direct spending, is connected to freedom of speech. Primarily because if you regulate money, you can regulate the amount of speech that people can make, and that's what freedom's about, doing for speaking as you want to. Or it's not actually, when we talk about freedom of speech, it's other things, too. It's about get-out-the-vote efforts, which involve speech, but also involves lots of other kinds of political activities. It really does and can strike at the heart of the First Amendment. So we disagree about that, and I think we disagree because I don't think that contributions have all that big effect on what comes out of Congress, and I don't think the spending itself is caused by that.
You realize over 90% of the legislation introduced into the last Congress was written by lobbyists, not by lawmakers, in its first drafts.
Well, I don't know who studied that and came up with that number. I do know that there's
the Congressional Budget Office.
There's been a lot of studies of contributions and their effect on legislation, their effect on congressional voting, and by people at MIT and other places, and they've found very little effect.
Well, let's get back to your assertion that money is free speech, and that was what the Supreme Court was saying in the Buckley decision. If money is free speech, then why do we have laws against bribery?
Well, I didn't say money is free speech. That's usually a way that people talk about Buckley and the whole argument to try to make it ridiculous, because obviously money is one thing.
But if you take the logic of Buckley, you have to legalize bribery of a public official.
Well, no, you don't, because bribery is something different. It's a purchase of favors directly, and in fact, the Buckley recognized that there was a corruption rationale that could restrict some uses of money, but that it also could easily go over into restrictions on freedom of speech, and that's what the attempt was to stop that by preventing limitations. The other thing you have to realize about limitations on spending is you would get limits on spending almost immediately by any Congress, whether dominated by Republicans or Democrats, because it makes it much easier to fend off challengers, particularly as you mentioned, you lower the spending limits. challengers, to be able to make a good race and to win in some cases against incumbents, have to spend at least minimum amounts, and in many cases more than challengers.
Because of the power of incumbency.
The power of incumbency. Yeah. Remember, these guys are in there for 2 years. Some people have estimated that they've already spent $1 million or more through staff time provided by public financing.
Yeah.
That gives them a hell of a head start.
But, you know, before the Buckley case in 71, I think, mm-hmm. 72, before that, the rule that prevailed was the 1949 decision, Kovacs versus Cooper, which said specifically, and I quote, to enforce freedom of speech in disregard of the rights of others would be harsh and arbitrary in itself. And this was a case, they said, city streets are recognized as a normal place for the exchange of ideas by speech or paper, but this does not mean the freedom of speech is beyond all control. And this specifically was a case about using amplifiers, you know, people going around they said you can stand on a street corner and shout, but you can't stand on a street corner with a PA system,
mm-hmm.
basically. Why not extend that logic? Or for that matter, why is Cato opposed to publicly financed elections?
Well, the first question first. I think the Supreme Court has over time, there's a CRS, Congressional Research Service piece, about 60 pages long. There's certain kinds of limitations on freedom of speech. Libel is not included under the First Amendment. But what we're talking about here really is sort of fundamental core political rights. We're not even talking about freedom of expression, freedom of artistic expression, those kinds of things. We're talking about people like, say, George Soros spending $25 million in one set of contributions to try to defeat George Bush in 2004. That seems to me a core political right that should be protected. Now, public.
Why? Why should somebody have a voice that's at least 25,000 to 250,000 times louder than a voice that the average person could marshal simply because they are rich?
Well, it wasn't just rich people. It was also organizations that were able to, for legal reasons, to provide larger sums than a normal contribution.
And why should organizations, which do not have the right to vote, they are not citizens, why should they be influencing the political process?
Organizations like labor unions were the ones I was thinking about. Well, there are ways that the political...
I'm as opposed to labor unions throwing money into the political process as I am corporations. I think that if they are not citizens, they should not be part of the political process.
Well, to go back to the question of what you're pointing toward is the whole question, and this comes back to Buckley, too, which is 25, 30 years old, but the question of equality versus freedom. The argument against people giving more than the contribution limits or larger sums is that, it should be like the right to vote. Everybody should be able to give the same, or nobody should be able to give more than others. And the first argument is, first of all, you have to believe that it has larger effects than others. And I cited evidence that that's not true. But secondly, if you're really making a choice against freedom in favor of equality, because you're going to have to constantly constrain what people can do. And the notion in the First Amendment is, in the Constitution, is that freedom and the connection to speech and to political activities more generally trumps equality. That's why the Buckley said that the notion that equality could justify constraining someone's freedom of speech.
But in the Buckley decision, the court said, I agree that political speech has to be a more highly protected form of speech. But in the Buckley decision, they came right out and they said, a restriction on the amount of money a person or group can spend on political communication reduces the quality of expression by restricting the number of issues discussed, the depth of their exploration, the size of the audience reached. This is because virtually every means of communicating ideas in today's mass society requires the expenditure of money. Now, that's only true in an absolute laissez-faire world where the gatekeepers of political expression say, you must pay us. That's not true if newspapers, televisions, radio stations are required as, in order for newspapers to maintain their subsidies with forthright postal service and radio and television stations, for example, to maintain their use of the airwaves, if they're required to give public time to candidates. It's not true if there's public financing of elections. I mean, the predicating assumption of Buckley, I believe, is false.
that there's private property in the media is basically what you're talking about. And
that the only way to communicate a political idea is with money.
Well, if it's so valuable, I think the public financing idea really boils down to one thing, which is that it should be public. If it's public financing is desirable, it should be financed by everyone. It's hard to see why, particularly the people, the shareholders in these in media and related kinds of corporations and businesses, should be required to bring about this.
So would Cato be opposed to something like the Maine or Arizona programs where the entire state...
Public financing is ultimately the use of a tax mechanism to force people to support candidates they wouldn't otherwise support.
So you oppose it because it's using tax dollars?
Well, I'm not the only one. I mean, it's a mess because, for example, the presidential public financing system had 30% support in 1978. It's now got about 7%. The public doesn't like these programs.
Well, perhaps because of all the propaganda thrown at them. I don't know.
That's because you haven't convinced them through rational argument.
Okay, well, it may well be. John Samples, he's the director of Cato's Center for Representative Government, Cato.org, the website. John, thanks for being with
us
today. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour, the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Speaking of Jefferson, the ultimate irony, Keith Ellison, you know, the first Muslim member of Congress, a convert to Islam. I believe he was born Catholic. He can trace his lineage, his roots in this country back to the 1700s. He's sworn in. You got Virgil Goody, this wacko right-wing Republican from Virginia, saying if American citizens don't wake up and adopt the Virgil Goody position on immigration, there will likely be more Muslims elected to office and demanding the use of the Koran. Well, it turns out that the Koran that Keith Ellison put his hand on to be sworn in as in the photo op, this is there is no Bible involved in the legal swearing in, turns out that the Koran was the personal property of Thomas Jefferson. It was Thomas Jefferson's personal Koran that Keith Ellison used to get sworn in on. And Virgil Goody represents the county where Thomas Jefferson was born. Now, tell me this is not weird. Anyhow, public financing of campaigns, and I want to wrap this up and then get on with the news and what everything else that's going on, and your calls as well. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. You could argue that the need for campaign finance reform became obvious in 1757. George Washington, he's running for the Virginia House of Burgesses. This is before there was a United States. And he serves a quart and a half of alcohol to every voter and gets criticized by his opponents because he made the buffet larger than normal to get people to come to get free food so that they would vote for him. George Washington throwing his money around a little there, and he won, actually. In 1783, Congress banned the practice of raising money from federal workers in patronage jobs. In 1907, Teddy Roosevelt was president. Congress passed a law making it illegal to give money to federal candidates for corporations to. I believe that law is still on the books. It's just been amended so many times and ignored so soundly. In 1971, Congress established spending limits. And that led directly to the Buckley case. 74, Watergate scandal. 76 was the Buckley case, 1976, Buckley versus Vallejo. 79, Congress bans soft money contributions. And then 7 members of Congress are accused of taking bribes in ab scam. Remember that? So. And communities around the country, Arizona, Connecticut, Maine, New Jersey, New Mexico, North Carolina, Vermont, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Portland, Oregon. Clean elections or full public financing. Stephen in Danville, California. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, listening to that last guy talking about money in campaigns, I was a candidate in the congressional primary in California District 11, hoping to run against Richard Pombo.
Mm-hmm.
And I raised basically a little over $25,000, and I got almost 20% of the vote.
Wow.
The official DCCC candidate raised over half a million dollars. He got 28% of the vote. And, you know, if I'd have had more money, I think I probably, I would have done better. Let's just say that.
Yeah. So did the guy who beat Pombo, I forget his name.
Jerry McNerney.
Jerry McNerney, thank you. Is he he was the official DCCC candidate?
No. He was a grassroots candidate that had run 2 years earlier.
Ah,
and
okay.
The Democratic Party decided we need a more conservative candidate to win this district.
Right, this is what Rahm Emanuel has been doing, is running around the country just supporting basically the corporate Democrats. I think it's one of the reasons why he resigned from head of the DCCC.
Well, we'll see how much of a change we get. I'm not that thrilled about, you know, where the main part of the Democratic Party is going, because they still are trying to get corporate money rather than representing we the people.
Yeah.
And we're losing the middle class, and we're losing the economy in this country, and we absolutely have to change our trade policies and bring jobs back.
Yeah, I agree. Stephen, well said, and good on you for running for political office, and
well,
I hope you do again.
I'm continuing on to the Assembly District, and if I can add one more thing, you gave a guy some advice the other day about where to start, and don't start, if there's no candidate, with your county central committee. Start with your local board of elections and secretary of state. Find out what you have to do in terms of filings.
Oh, this is if you want to run for political office.
If you want to run for political office, right?
Yeah.
Because if you start off at the central committee, there's frequently a lot of infighting and ossified layers.
Oh, yeah. My advice, when I was giving that advice, it wasn't if you want to run for office. It was if you want to become part of the process of deciding who runs for office. If you want to become active in the local party.
I think your advice is solid. You had a call from one guy who said there was no candidate running in his district. So he was thinking about running. So I was thinking specifically about that guy.
Yeah, okay.
And if people want to run, say, look, go to the Secretary of State website. Go to the local board of elections, find out what filings you have to do, what hoops you got to jump through. Because in California, you have to get a certain number of qualified nomination signatures just to get in there, and there's rigid qualifications on those.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all that that comes along with it. But I can hear the music, so I can tell we're running out of time.
We got to take a break at the bottom of the hour. Stephen, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to us on the Quake there. I appreciate it. Yeah, now Bush and Cheney, speaking of all this, maybe if we just stopped funding contractors in Iraq, the war would end. Let's talk about that. Bush and Cheney, General Casey, the next scapegoat. How do we get out of Iraq? 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the radio home of democracy. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Program. The laughing lefty in the chat room puts it well. We need to surge and accelerate for the next 6 months to achieve victory by turning the corner and staying the course to set a new way forwards while adjusting our strategies so we can fight them there so we don't have to fight them here. Yeah. John Abizade. CENTCOM commander, General John Abizade, just about 2 weeks ago, said to Congress, quote, I met with every divisional commander, General Casey, the Corps commander, General Dempsey. We all talked together, and I said, in your professional opinion, if we were able to bring in more American troops now, does it add considerably to our ability to achieve success in Iraq? And they all said no. End of quote. From John Abizade's testimony before Congress. He's the CENTCOM commander. Well, number one, it looks like the Bushies are getting ready to take down Casey, make him the scapegoat. But number two, this is a huge political twofer. George W. Bush is going to be pushing his surge option. He's going to be throwing this thing out here. And the reason it's a political twofer is, number one, if he gets the money from Congress and he does his surge, and in the background after the surge, you know, he's also handing, really what needs to be done is giving enough money to the Iraqi government that they can hire people, that they can stop the 60% unemployment rate, that they can build a government and rebuild their middle class. When they do that, it's going to dramatically slow down, you know, this ongoing civil war. So, you know, in the background, they're going to be doing some of the things that will help, but in the foreground, they're going to be doing the surge. So if he gets it, it may help. The military part of it's not going to help, but the other stuff associated with it may help. In other words, this is a political strategy, not a military one, number one. And number two, if Congress says to him, no, you can't have the money, which is what many of us are very inclined to argue very strongly Congress should be saying, is, hey, wait a minute, sorry, no more money for this war. Then Bush gets to say, well, we didn't win in Iraq because Congress wouldn't give me the money. It's the fault of the Democrats. And he can shift the blame. It's just like the John McCain strategy. This is an absolute winner. Last night, Brian Williams on NBC, NBC News, introducing Jim Mikuláševsky, talking about this, and Williams sets it up. First of all, here he is.
NBC News Pentagon correspondent Jim Mikuláševsky has learned that according to U.S. officials, President Bush is prepared to announce what is being called a strategy of surge and accelerate in Iraq.
Surge and accelerate. Now, they're not calling this an escalation. No, we'd never use that word. That's an old Vietnam word. Surge and accelerate.
Iraq, which would involve, bottom line, some 20,000 additional American troops being sent to Iraq. Jim is with us from the Pentagon with more on this tonight. Jim, good evening.
And this is where Jim Mikuláševsky comes in and points out that this, and we were told, this is just a political strategy.
Good evening, Brian. Administration officials told us late today that President Bush has now all but decided to surge those additional combat troops into Baghdad to try to get control over the violence there. And only then could they accelerate the turnover of territory to Iraqi security forces. Fact is, they're just not up to the task yet. The plan would also throw more U.S. money at Iraq for reconstruction and a jobs program. Now, interestingly enough...
See, now, this is the point. The reconstruction and jobs program is going to be the stuff that's going to help, number one. So, with or without the surge. And then he says, but interestingly enough...
One administration official admitted to... that this surge option is more of a political decision than a military one because the American people have simply run out of patience and President Bush is running out of time to achieve some kind of success in Iraq. And while this plan will clearly draw some stiff opposition up on Capitol Hill, the president's expected to announce it a week from today.
So, yes, this is a week from yesterday. Next Tuesday, Bush will be announcing this. Now, here's the bottom line. You can't have, and this goes back to the whole Saddam show trial and hanging as well. Saddam Hussein, if we're going to be in the business, first of all, if we're going to be in the business of running around the world, taking down tin pot dictators and trying them for war crimes, there's a whole lot of countries that have to get in line, number one, and that's not what we're about. But if we're going to do that, okay, we invaded Iraq, we're going to do that with Saddam Hussein, we should have turned him over to the International Criminal Court at The Hague. It's just that simple. A Nuremberg-style tribunal, so that we say to other dictators, this is how we do it. This is the international community dealing with this. That, in some small way, would even ratify Bush's invasion. You know, arguably, Bush theoretically would get some political bonus from that. The problem, of course, is that if there was a fair and open trial of Saddam Hussein, particularly in the International Criminal Court in The Hague, all the dirty laundry of Bush Sr. and Reagan would come out, and Rumsfeld's support of Saddam Hussein and the U.S.'s support are propping him up, are providing him with the gas that he used to kill people, are providing him, you know, the supporting him in the war against Iran, you know, just all that whole thing. It would all come out, and they just don't want that to come out. So, number one, you know, that should have happened. Number two, And this is, I think, probably the most important most important concept here, is that if you don't have a strong middle class, you can't have a democracy. You can't have a functional democracy. You can have a sham democracy. But what's going to happen is if you don't have a middle class, people are going to vote for the strong man. They're going to say, you know, whoever offers them the most. I remember, and this gets back to our, you know, the whole thing about public financing of elections in a way. I remember when I was in Russia, when the first elections were held in Russia in 1,000 years of Russia being a nation. And Vladimir Zhirinovsky was on the ballot. He was running against Boris Yeltsin, as I recall, among others. And I was staying at a home, this was in Kaliningrad, I was staying at a home where the husband was Russian and the wife was German-Russian. She was ethnically German. The Germans had controlled that part of Russia for, you know, on and off. They had gone back and forth over the years. And the Russians took it back in World War II. It was called Königsberg before it was called Kaliningrad, Kingstown, and in German. So anyhow, she spoke German and Russian, and he spoke Russian, and I didn't speak Russian. My daughter does, but I don't. But I speak some German. And so I'm sitting there, and we're watching TV, and we're watching the election coverage. It's the day of the election. And this guy comes on TV, and he's pounding his fist on the table and pointing at the screen, and rah, 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 like that. And all of a sudden, the wife of this family sitting next to me breaks out laughing, and her husband's looking at her like baffled. Now, this guy on TV is ranting in Russian. They both understand what he's saying. But the husband is like, why are you laughing? And she's laughing. And so I said to her, you know, why in German, I said, you know, why are you laughing? You know, what's going on with this? And she says to me in German, she says, that's Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the nationalist candidate. He's their kind of equivalent of Pat Buchanan, the hyper right winger. And he just said that anybody who votes for him will get a pint of vodka and a chicken. Or maybe it was a turkey, one or the other. Anyhow, a pint of vodka and a turkey, let's say it was, as I recall. And then the TV screen flashes to these commentators, a man and woman in front of a, you know, one of these plywood TV sets, you know, that look like, you know, your local TV newsroom. That was the state of the art in Russia. This was, what, 15 years ago. And they flash to that, and these two are having this very serious discussion. And I said, what are they talking about? And she said, they're trying to figure out where he's going to get all the vodka and all the turkeys. Are there that many turkeys in Russia? You know, how's he going to distribute them? How's he going to do this? And she, like I thought, this is absurd. But that's what happens when you don't have a strong middle class. When you don't have a strong middle class, whoever makes the biggest promise, I mean, we've seen this in the Palestinian territories. We saw this in Palestine. You see this all across Africa. We've seen it in the past in South America, where you don't have a strong middle class and you don't have political free speech. The average person doesn't have a chance to speak, and the only candidates who are running are the oligarchs. The only candidates who are running are those who have access to enormous wealth and power. You have a sham democracy. And by destroying the Iraqi middle class, what little was left of it after 9 years of sanctions, by going in, Paul Bremer, and going in and saying, okay, that's it, we're going to take out the Iraqi middle class. Well, actually, they believed they were going to build it. I really believe these guys thought, they believed their own PR. They thought that they would create a neoconservative paradise. They were going to do to Iraq what they wanted to do to America, and when it was successful, they were going to say to Americans, see, this really works. We should do this in America. And they do away with Social Security, do away with welfare programs, do away with state-paid medical care, in other words, you know, single-payer health care, do away with that, make unions illegal, replace progressive taxes with a flat tax of 15%, allow corporations to do anything they want, bring in anybody from outside the country. This was going to be year zero, as Naomi Klein described it in a brilliant article she wrote about this back about 2 years ago. The neocons, they were reinventing Iraq in their own image. And what did it do? It produced 60% unemployment. It produced these giant, you know, defense contractors making huge fortunes over there, bringing in labor from Pakistan and Sri Lanka, people who are willing to work for even less than the Iraqis are willing to work for, and huge unemployment, and a whole lot of very, very angry people. So how do you expect to have a fair trial and a reasonable execution? I'm opposed to the death penalty to begin with, but how do you expect to have any of that kind of due process actually working in a democracy when you don't even have a middle class? So, you know, the whole Iraq thing from the beginning was a disaster, and now this whole thing with Saddam has made it even worse. So anyhow, I got off on a rant there. We'll get back to your phone calls right after this break. It's 866-440-8466, our number. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some. It was a beautiful day, sun deep down. I heard the radio walk. I was driving. The trees went by. Me and Dale were singing. And welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Mark in Middleville, Michigan. Hey, Mark, listening on WTKG, Clear Channel in Grand Rapids. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Tom, my question's on no-bid contracts.
Yes, sir.
Why is it that Eric Prince, a former Navy SEAL, is the owner of Blackwater Corporation? He's given no-bid contracts in Iraq. Is it because his sister is Betsy Prince DeVos, the former Republican chairwoman for Michigan? His brother-in-law, Dick DeVos, the former governor candidate for Michigan for the Republicans? Or is it because he's the best there is? And couldn't that money be spent better locally in Iraq?
Or is there a third option that has to do with his participation in fundamentalist Christian causes? There's a very interesting piece over on the truthdig.com, David. We were looking at that. In fact, if you have that article, just toss it over here. This is a pretty amazing piece. The Chris Hedges, who's the former New York Times Mideast bureau chief, has a new book out. And the title of the book is American Fascist, the Christian Right and the War on America. And he says, Eric Prince, the secretive, I'm quoting now from his article in Truthdig, Eric Prince, the secretive mega-millionaire right-wing Christian founder of Blackwater, the private security firm that has built a formidable mercenary force in Iraq, champions his country as a patriotic extension of the U.S. military, and you know, goes on. But he suggests that, at least my understanding, the way that I'm reading this is that Chris Hedges is suggesting that it might have more to do with that. But, you know, yeah, Dick DeVos, I didn't realize that he was involved with Dick DeVos. That's pretty amazing. Mark, thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. Ian in San Francisco, listening on the Quake, KQKE. Hey, Ian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Good morning. Listen, I just wanted to suggest that we take a look at the timing. Bush has told us he's going to make his announcement on the acceleration of their and surge and accelerate. As I understand it, you said it's going to be like next Tuesday or Wednesday?
Tuesday, yeah.
Tuesday.
This is according to NBC News.
Well, yeah. Now, you notice he was going to announce this before Christmas.
Yeah.
But then they said, well, no, let's do it a different time. We're still doing a lot of talking and all that kind of
let's
stuff.
Let's sabotage the Democrats' desire to have some FaceTime on TV.
Exactly. He's doing it right in the middle of the 100 hours that Nancy Pelosi has announced for the various issues they're going to bring up.
And you can guarantee that if she's going to be talking about increasing the minimum wage at 10 a.m., that he's going to make his announcement at 10 a.m. And if she's doing it at 2 p.m., he'll make his announcement at 2 p.m. And you're absolutely right, Ian. You're absolutely spot on right. Thank you very much. Ray in Houston, Texas, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Ray.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Good.
I was calling about some information that I've been looking for that you mentioned about the Reagan, the Bush Sr., and the current administration, a lot of the truth coming out had they surrendered Saddam to the International Commission
right in
Hague. Now, many years ago, before all this, the Gulf War and all the situation in, now, I had read an article out of London that timelined the Carter administration and the Iran hostage situation. And it also implicated George Bush Sr. in the October surprise as far as bringing the hostage.
Yeah, there's two books that have been written about that, one by Gary Sick and one by Barbara Honegger. They're both titled October Surprise, and they both lay it out. If you want more information, I mean, it's fairly easy to Google the stuff. I think Mother Jones actually did a really, really good piece on this. As I recall, it was Mother Jones Magazine. But there's no shortage of information out there about the relationship between Bush Sr., Reagan, Don Rumsfeld, and Saddam Hussein. I mean, it's all over the place, laying around. It's just easy to pick up. Thanks a lot for the call. Jennifer in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Jennifer.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment on what the gentleman from the Cato Institute said.
Yes.
He made the statement that corporations, corporate contributions don't make any difference in legislation. I think that's the most absurd thing anyone's ever said on
well,
the show.
Good point. And I should have called him on it. It's also illegal. You know, the Supreme Court has ruled that if a corporation doesn't behave in a way that advances the interests of their stockholders, then their directors, their senior management has committed a crime. They failed in their fiduciary responsibility. So the
exactly.
only reason that you would give a campaign contribution is because you expect something for it.
Exactly. Why else would they do it?
Yeah, in fact, legally.
I don't think anyone in America would be so naive as to think that wasn't true.
Yeah.
Thanks
well
a
said,
lot, Jennifer. Tom.
Thank you. I appreciate the call. Phil in Palo Alto, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Phil.
Yeah, I guess the previous caller got to one of my points, which is that if the legislation is not influenced by contributions, then we need to file shareholder lawsuits because these corporations are wasting money.
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about $1 billion in the last election cycle.
Yeah, and what I found interesting, and it's kind of subtle, is that he dismissed your citations to research and said, well, I haven't read that, so I don't know anything about it. But then he introduced his, and then later in his talk, he cited them as fact as well, you know, these MIT studies. And then later he says, well, it's all well known that contributions don't influence legislation.
Yes, the talking points of the right.
Yeah, we need to kind of be calling people on making up facts.
Yeah, it's good. Thank you, Phil. I think you just did. You just accomplished it. I appreciate the call, and thank you very much. It's really pretty startling when you get to the whole thing here. Will in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Will, I think, there it goes. Will, I'm going to put you on hold here. We'll come back to you after the news at the top of the hour. It's amazing how fast time flies. What are the Democrats going to do? How are they going to deal with this? Bush is going to come in and he's going to say, this is what we need to get us out of Iraq. Give me another $100 billion and the lives of another 1,000 soldiers. I mean, that's essentially what he's going to be asking for. We tried the troop surge thing. We tried it in Fallujah. We tried it in Baghdad, actually, just a couple months ago. Yeah, if you want to kill a bunch of people, if you want to turn over a wasteland of a city, if you want to bomb the city back to the Stone Age, maybe you'll have peace. I don't know. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
He's even doing it in the Wall Street Journal, which came out with their new format this week, by the way, which I think sucks. It's not the old Wall Street Journal. It's now the USA Today version of it. But in any case, George W. Bush, welcome back to the program. The Tom Hartman Program here. Tom Hartman with you. That's me. George W. Bush. By George W. Bush is what it says up at the top of page A13, the opinion section of today's Wall Street Journal. Now, I don't think anybody in America actually believes that George W. Bush wrote this, because the sentences are coherent, grammatically correct. But nonetheless, his speechwriter did a reasonably good job. But, I mean, once again, let's conflate 9/11 and Iraq, right? I mean, this is guy's mantra. Let's conflate 9/11 and Iraq. It's just all about 9. Our priorities. This is from the Wall Street Journal today, an article by George W. Bush. And if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you. But in any case, our priorities begin with defeating the terrorists who killed thousands of innocent Americans on September 11, 2001, and who are working hard to attack us again. These terrorists are part of a broader extremist movement that is now doing everything it can to defeat us in Iraq. Yes, in Iraq we are fighting the guys who hit us on 9/11. You get that? Do you think anybody still believes this stuff? Yes. Yeah. Tragically. Everybody watches Fox News. Tragically. In the days ahead, he says, I will be addressing our nation about a new strategy to help the Iraqi people gain control of the security situation and hasten the day when the Iraqi government gains full control over its affairs. Ultimately, Iraq must resolve the most pressing issues facing them. We can't do it for them, but we can help Iraq defeat the extremists inside and outside of Iraq. Wait a minute. Before we invaded Iraq, there had never, ever, inside that country, been an act of terrorism. It had never happened, ever, until we invaded Iraq. Well, I don't know, maybe 7,000 years ago when Gilgamesh was running the country, but in the modern history of Iraq. So now we're going to defeat what we created. People saying, no thanks, please, I really don't want you occupying my country. Thank you very much. He also writes, or George W. Bush's speechwriter also writes in today's Wall Street Journal, it's also a fact that our tax cuts had fueled robust economic growth and record revenues. Well, yeah, that's probably true for most of the readers of the Wall Street Journal. If you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, you're doing really well. You're doing really well. It was a very good year. If you make your living drawing a paycheck, you're not doing as well as you were in 1978. By continuing these policies, he says, we can balance the federal budget by 2012. Come on. Now, the bottom line is that tax relief and spending restraint are good for the American worker. Well, then why don't you try it for the American worker? Raise taxes on corporations. Reduce taxes on workers. After all, Ronald Reagan signed the largest tax increase in the history of the United States on working people in America, doubling the FICA tax, doubling the Social Security tax. How about making it good for us? No. He just wanted to drop taxes down to 15% for people who passively earn their income. Well, anyhow, here's the bottom line. There's this wild confluence coming. We all thought maybe for a minute or two that the Democrats getting elected and taking control of the House and Senate would mean that Bush would back down, the Republicans would quiet down, maybe some rational heads would prevail and some decent things would happen in America. No, ain't gonna happen. Nancy Pelosi, for example, 2 years ago, when the Republicans took control of the House of Representatives in 1994, they gave in and they said, okay, we're going to change how things are done here. We're going to make it absolutely impossible for the Democrats to do anything. They can't hold hearings. Remember John Conyers wanted to hold hearings into what happened in Ohio in 2004? He had to do it in a closet in the basement of the House. He couldn't, it was not an official hit, there was no official transcript. I mean, he called witnesses and everything, but it was, and no Republicans showed up. That wasn't the first time, it wasn't the only time. But basically the Republicans said, okay, now that we're in charge, Democrats can't do anything. Even though when the Democrats were in charge, but, you know, yes, there had been some abuses, I'll cop to that. I'm not here to apologize for the Democratic Party, but the bottom line is nothing like what the Republicans have done. So 2 years ago, Nancy Pelosi sends this letter to Denny Hastert saying, how about a Bill of Rights for the minority, for the Democrats in Congress? How about once in a while letting us introduce legislation? How about once in a while letting us call a witness? How about once in a while, and Denny Hastert didn't even bother to answer her. Didn't even bother to send a, thank you, Nancy, I got your letter. I realize you're the minority leader and respected position And I appreciate your thinking about this, but we're just going to pass. Not even the courtesy of a thank you very much, but no thanks. He ignored it. So today the Republicans are trotting out Nancy Pelosi's letter and saying, you know that Nancy Pelosi, she had a pretty good idea. Why don't you Democrats do this? Please don't do to us what we did to you. And the bizarre and sad thing, it may well be that the Democrats will not do to the Republicans what the Republicans did to them. I think they should for at least, actually what I think should happen, a caller to my morning show called and suggested this, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. We were having a conversation with Congressman Brian Baird from Washington State, and he said, this is the caller, he said what we should do, what the Democrats should do is they should say that the Republicans are going to have to operate under the same rules that they had before, until a rule is passed that the rules for the House of Representatives can only be passed with a 75% plus one vote majority. In other words, when the Republicans take control again, they can't lock out the Democrats. And then you pass rules that are more egalitarian, that let both parties have a say. Those rules can only be changed by a 75% plus one vote majority, a supermajority. You know, like it takes to amend the Constitution. That's really very wise. But anyhow, in the meantime, Bush is getting set to blame Casey for the failures up to this point. This is from the New York Times. Chaos overran Iraq plan in 06, Bush team says. Yeah, right. President Bush began 2006 assuring the country that he had a strategy for victory in Iraq, right? David Sanger, Michael Gordon, and John Burns in the New York Times. He ended the year closeted with his war cabinet on his ranch trying to devise a new strategy because the existing one had collapsed. The original plan, championed by General George W. Casey Jr., the top commander in Baghdad and backed by Donald Rumsfeld, then the defense secretary, called for turning over responsibility for security to the Iraqis, shrinking the number of American bases and beginning the gradual withdrawal of American troops. But the plan collapsed with Iraq's ferocious unraveling, which took most of Mr. Bush's war council by surprise. How could it take them by surprise when a million of us were in the streets in the fall of 2002 saying, if you invade Iraq, it's going to be house-to-house combat? I mean, look at the lessons of history. People don't like their countries being occupied, especially big countries, especially proud people. But we certainly didn't like it in 1812 when the Canadians and the British invaded us. We fought them back, even though they burned the White House. We fought them back in the War of 1812. And we didn't see fit to, and James Madison, who was president at the time, didn't say, oh, gee, look at this. The Canadians and the British, they burned the White House. Therefore, we need to suspend habeas corpus. Let's do away with that pesky Bill of Rights. Let's get rid of the First, the Fourth, the Fifth, the Sixth, the Seventh, and the Eighth Amendments to the Constitution. We don't need them anyway. No. And then Bush comes along and says, this is the first time we've been attacked on American soil. I'm sorry. He's just assuming that Americans are so ignorant of their history that they don't remember that there was a war in 1812 in which Dolly Madison rescued from the burning White House that picture of George Washington's hanging there. And in part, Americans don't remember that because of the wars against the teaching of civics in the 1980s waged under the Reagan administration when these guys, and this is still going on, now they're doing it at the college level. David Horowitz running around going, ah, there's communist professors. Well, they were doing that in the 1980s about high school civics teachers, remember? Those liberal teachers, they're all members of the union. And they started rewriting the civics books. And so now, you know, it's like, what was the year that Columbus discovered North America? Multiple choice questions. Memorized dates. That passes for civics instruction in America now. Back with your calls and more news of the day. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi, 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to the place where reason is our lifestyle choice, the Tom Hartman Program, 21 minutes past the hour. For our listeners in the Seattle area listening on Talk 1090, you may have already heard, but if not, a young person was shot at Foss High School, apparently, this morning between 7:15 and 7:30 a.m. Pacific time. Police trying to track down the shooter. They believe they know who did it. And, you know, we'll see how this plays out. Just one of those tragedies. In our thoughts, our best wishes, our prayers with the family. I mean, that's a tough one. That's a real tough one. 1-866-440-8466. Will in Lansing. Hey, Will, thanks for hanging on.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. First-time caller here. Long-time listener, though.
Thank you. What's up? And you're calling from my hometown.
Cool. I think Reconstruction and jobs in Iraq would be a disaster under the Bush administration, similar to the disaster that occurred at Camp Falcon last October. I don't know if you're familiar with that incident.
Apparently I'm not. It's not ringing any bells for me. Tell me about it.
Well, what happened at Camp Falcon was it was a base that was built with help from Iraqi nationals. Mm-hmm. And because of that, insurgents were able to do covert reconnaissance and find out exactly how the base was laid out.
Mm-hmm.
And in October of last year, they targeted the ammo dump at Camp Falcon with their mortar fire.
Oh, and this is the one we're still not sure how many Americans might have died or how many people died, period. I mean,
well,
they
say there were over 300 casualties and over $1 billion worth of destroyed material.
Yeah.
Bush's idea of reconstruction in Iraq is building permanent military bases and creating jobs by hiring Iraqi nationals to build those bases is just going to lead to more of the same stuff that happened at Camp Falcon.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. On the other hand, if he was to finally say, okay, you're right, Franklin Roosevelt was right, Harry Truman was right, George Marshall was right, the way to rebuild a country, you know, the schools, the bridges, this is a country that has, 2.5 hours a day of electricity? A third of the country does not, or only a third of the country has clean drinking water. I mean, the way to rebuild the infrastructure of a country is to give the money to the local industry, to the local government, to hire local industry, thereby building and creating local industry, which will do the work. I mean, that would actually put Iraqis back to work. They'd be rebuilding their own infrastructure, their own country, give them a sense of pride and self. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that could come out of that, isn't there?
Exactly.
But you don't think that Bush is going to do that?
No, I think he's just going to use Iraqi labor to build military bases for the United States.
See, I don't think they'll do that. I think you're right that they've learned the lesson of Camp Falcon, and I suspect that they're going to do what they're starting to look back now at the Marshall Plan, and they're going to say, okay, this works. We know it works. And what's going to happen is that the administration is not going to point this out, and neither is the press in the United States, if they have success with it, if that's what they do. And so, you know, this because the original plan, and this is not any big secret, the original plan of the neocons was to show that the Marshall Plan was wrong, that the rebuilding of Iraq and the rebuilding of Germany and the rebuilding of Japan by basically helping build institutions and companies inside those countries by supplying them with money was, you know, just a fluke. I mean, the conservatives for 60 years have been saying, oh, it's just a fluke. It wasn't because, you know, the Constitution guaranteed them, you know, the rights of the right to work and the right to unionize and job security and a national health care program, and that, you know, we helped them. You know, it's just a fluke. And so we're going to prove with Iraq that it was just a fluke. We're just going to bring in Halliburton and we'll show you how to build a country. And, you know, just like with New Orleans. So that's my prediction anyway. Will, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Love you. Love the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. A couple things. A topic came up while I was listening, if I may.
Sure.
In addition to the original one. A mulligan in golf is a do-over. And generally the only thing that gets hurt is one's humility or their person.
Mm-hmm.
And
in the game of golf.
In the game of golf.
Yeah.
A mulligan, it's so offensive to believe that he's believing that this mulligan here is original strategy or somehow is the correct way to be doing things, and the right way to do it should have been the planning and attacking the right country, which we did originally, Afghanistan, and the right people for the right reason.
Well, and for that matter, I don't think we should have attacked Afghanistan when the Taliban said that they would hand over Osama bin Laden to a third party, to a neutral nation for trial.
Yes.
I think we should have said, fine, do it, and it would have been the end of it.
Can I have another moment?
Yeah, sure. Anyway, I'll stick around. We got to take a break here, Dave, but hang on and we'll get right back to you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Massachusetts, by the way, debating what they're going to do about gay marriage and the future of that. I want to rant on that a little bit when we come back, too. But we'll be back with your calls and more. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. Folks in the chat room pointing out that last night was a full moon. That explains a lot. I woke up at 1 o'clock this morning, never did get back to sleep. Anyhow, Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom.
Oh, we were talking before the break, yes.
Yes, we can go move forward, though.
Okay.
I was watching or listening to C-SPAN on Sirius Radio on your program this morning or afternoon, and I'm going to hack her name and my apologies to her because I believe I appreciate her because I watch her on C-SPAN at night all the time hammering down some of the policies, and it's a representative from Florida, and it's a woman, and her name, she's a Democrat, and it's Wolfelman Schultz. I'm not sure. I apologize to her for the hacking of her name, but she had said on the program that the Democrats plan on investigating all the activities of the current administration, but they will not hold them accountable because that's not what the public wanted. They don't want us to.
What?
They weren't put in. Watch
a member of Congress said this on C-SPAN?
Watch it. I called up a few minutes later, and I'll tell you what I said to them, but let me finish the statement. That we did not put them in office to either impeach or to, you know, challenge his authority to anything. We're just there to investigate, just to make sure it doesn't happen again. Not to reinforce the laws. So when we can't hold Nixon accountable, we can't hold Reagan.
This is the terrible precedent that Jerry Ford set, and his pardoning of Nixon set up Bush's pardoning of all the Reagan era criminals, and that has set up now Cheney, you know, applauding the thing, and everybody, the whole right wing corporate media applauding Jerry Ford for this has set up the pardoning of Scooter Libby and everybody else, all the criminals who are going to get busted and prosecuted out of the Bush administration.
Does it ever end?
Including possibly Bush himself.
When do the Americans get justice? I don't understand.
Well, I think that we will soon if we hold our elected officials accountable. And Dave, you're
going to hold him accountable.
This is where you need to call your member of Congress there in Buffalo, New York, and you also need to call that woman from Florida and give her staffer a piece of your mind. And we need to be letting our elected officials know that we would like this administration to be held accountable for their actions. Thank you very much. It's time for that. Dave, thanks for the call, and thanks for putting that out. I appreciate it. Alan in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KOPT. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to add to your knowledge of history, if I could, concerning times that the U.S. mainland has been attacked.
In contradiction of George Bush's assertion that the only time we've been attacked was on 9/11?
Well, between 1812 and then, actually, on the Pacific coast, not too far from you, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you're talking about the balloons that the Japanese floated over here and dropped the firebombs?
Well, I was going to mention that, too. I'm referring to the submarine that fired on Fort Stevens.
Oh, I didn't even know about that one. I knew about the balloons.
Yeah, and your call screener asked me for a date, so while I was waiting for you, I went online.
Uh-huh.
Happened the night of June 21st in 1942.
Interesting.
And
the United States mainland was attacked.
They identified the submarine as the I-25.
Yeah.
And it fired 5.5-inch shells in the vicinity of the fort. I've been to Battery Russell at the fort.
Uh-huh.
It's open to the public. And I thought that I had gotten the idea that the fort returned fire. This article says that the fort commander refused to allow them to return fire.
Wow.
But,
then
we went and interned the Japanese and took their property away and et cetera, et cetera. So.
Yeah, and that, I mean, you know, that's a shameful era in American history, and you would think that we would learn from it. But Roosevelt did.
Following that model.
Yeah, Roosevelt created the concentration camps, and it was wrong. And he also didn't say, okay, that's it, no more habeas corpus nationwide anyway. That's not to say that what he did was right, but you know, Bush is actually enshrining permanently into law. At least Roosevelt's actions were temporary for the duration of the war. Bush is you know, doing away with American democracy. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
I'd love to chat NLP with you sometime too. I tried to get in Friday and you were on a roll. So
yeah, we need to. I think in the future what we'll do is we'll talk about it a little bit in the first half of the hour, and then we'll just toss it open to calls and discuss the topic in the second half of the hour as we continue with that. Alan, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening there on KOPT and Eugene. This, the Financial Times, the kind of business week of the UK. Financial Times is more highly regarded than Business Week. I'm not quite sure how to, you know, what's a good analogy. Maybe there isn't one, because the Financial Times is widely read in the United States. In any case, they reported today, and I quote, U.S. dependence on the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries for its oil imports. That's OPEC countries. U.S. dependence on OPEC countries for its oil imports has risen to its highest level in 15 years. 52% of the oil that we import into the United States is now coming from OPEC countries. 70% is total foreign oil, up from 58% when George Bush came into office. Bush comes into office, we're importing 58% of our oil. Now we're importing 70% of our oil. In 2001, what did Bush say about this? He said, we can produce more energy at home while protecting our environment, and we must. We can produce more electricity to meet demand, and we must. We can promote alternative energy sources and conservation, and we must. America must become more energy independent, and we will. And then we didn't. That was in February of 2001. So what does he do? He puts Dick Cheney in charge of the Energy Task Force and the Counterterrorism Task Force to stop Osama bin Laden from striking America and to make America more energy independent. So Dick Cheney never meets, the Counterterrorism Task Force never even meets until September of 2001. And the Energy Task Force sits around dividing up the oil fields of Iraq, deciding which oil companies are going to sell Iraq's oil to. And that's 2001. 2002, we're becoming more dependent upon foreign oil. Remember, when Bush comes into office in 2000, 52% of our oil, 58% of our oil is imported. Now it's 70%. 2002, we're becoming more dependent on oil. Bush gives a speech, January 29th, State of the Union Address. Good jobs also depend on reliable and affordable energy. This Congress must act to encourage conservation, promote technology, build infrastructure. It must act to increase energy production at home so America is less dependent on foreign oil. Yeah, right. And he didn't do anything about it in 2002. And so in 2003, he comes along. And in his State of the Union Address on January 28, 2003, he says, our third goal is to promote energy independence for our country while dramatically improving the environment. Even more, I ask you to take a crucial step and protect our environment in ways that generations before us could not have imagined. And then what does he do? He increases the amount of mercury you can put in the air. Yes, let's burn more coal. So 2004 comes, his State of the Union Address, January 20, 2004. Consumers and businesses need reliable supply. Now, all through this time, we're every single year increasing our reliance on foreign oil. The Saudis making more and more money, which probably is making the Bush family very happy. After all, they're basically in bed with each other. 2004, consumers and businesses need reliable supplies of energy to make our economy run. So I urge you to pass legislation to modernize our electricity system, promote conservation, and make America less dependent on foreign sources of energy. Yeah, right. Bush and the Republican Congress, they did a marvelous job of that, didn't they? As I noted at the beginning of this rant, the Financial Times just reported that we are at an all-time high for dependence on foreign oil and dependence on OPEC oil. 2005. Keep our economy growing, we need reliable supplies of affordable, environmentally responsible energy. I urge Congress to pass legislation that makes America more secure and less energy, less dependent on foreign energy. Oh, yeah? Yeah. Unfortunately, he never submitted such legislation, and the Republican Congress never passed such legislation, which takes us to last year, 2006, the State of the Union, January 31st, 2006. Bush says, keeping America competitive requires affordable energy. And here we have a serious problem. America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world. The best way to break this addiction is through technology. I don't see anybody putting those solar collectors back on the roof of the White House that Jimmy Carter had there. So now, we get this. This is incredible. I mean, this is absolutely, this energy independence will be the central theme. This is from the Financial Times. Quote, Al Hubbard, chairman of the National Economic Council, who's coordinating White House energy policy, has also raised expectations. In a speech at DePauw University, he predicted, quote, headlines above the fold that will knock your socks off in terms of our commitment to energy independence. That's right, my friends. 6 years in a row, George Bush gets up on his hind legs and gives a speech about how we need to become energy independent. And every single year, he and the Republicans make us more energy dependent upon Middle Eastern sources. And he's going to do it one more time. And he thinks we're going to buy it. In fact, they're bragging about it. He's got the chairman of his National Economic Council out there bragging about it. It's going to knock our socks off. Yeah. Maybe if he did something, it would knock our socks off. Wouldn't that be a nice idea? That would be a good plan. Nice start. Amazing. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. 866-440-THOM, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. Right here on the True People's Radio.
Let's head on down the road. There's somewhere I gotta go. And you don't know how it feels. You don't know how it feels.
And welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program, listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors and our affiliated stations. Let them know you're listening. Sacred Grounds Coffee, our national sponsors, for example, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, sacredgroundscoffee.com, 1-800-425-2532. Or Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods at smalldog.com, 1-800-511-MAX. Or the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE. EcoWine.com. And, of course, your local sponsors, because they talk to the local stations, and, as you can. It's important stuff to support Progressive Talk Radio. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joe in Lake Placid, New York, listening on WTWK. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Well, Tom, I just want to reiterate what many of your listeners do. You're one of the greatest things that ever happened on radio.
Well, thank you, Joe.
I just finished reading your book.
The new one, you mean Screwed?
Yes.
Oh, hey, by the way, the March issue of Hustler magazine, which hits the newsstand sometime in the next couple of weeks, has about a 3-page article, an interview with me about Screwed and about the topics of that book. And there's no sexual innuendo or double entendres or anything. It's just a really good, solid, straight-up piece about the death of the middle class.
I'll have to look it up.
So, yeah, now all our male listeners have an excuse to go out and buy a copy of Hustler. It's the March issue.
Yes.
Well, so anyhow, Joe, what's up?
What I want to say is I had a similar situation as your dad. Your dad was in the metal industry, right?
Yeah, he worked in a tool and die shop. And before that, actually, when he was first exposed to asbestos, it was at the it was in a steel and aluminum plant up in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Okay, well, I've been a sheet metal worker all my life. I've been retired now, but in a recent X-ray some weeks ago, they noted some indication of asbestosis.
Nice.
Not serious, but I'm aware of it.
Yeah.
And getting back.
Don't smoke.
No, I never did smoke. That's the worst habit in life.
Yeah.
What I wanted to refer is to unions. I'm a pretty old guy. When I first came out of the Navy, I went to work under the GI Bill and worked for your shop. And you won't believe what I'm going to tell you, but they had a sort of a quasi-union in that shop, and they were negotiating for a 15-cent an hour across-the-board raise for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the boss's counter offered with a nickel offer. We had four grades, A mechanic, B mechanic, C mechanic, D mechanic, and helper. So they offered the union guys 5 cents, 4 cents, 3 cents, and 2 cents. I'm serious.
Well, that was actually, you know, Joe, if you're talking about 45 years ago, 5 cents was worth about 50 cents now.
Well, I understand that, but still the audacity of winning, giving a guy a 2 cent an hour raise.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right.
So, people don't realize how important unions are. Some of the unions I can agree with, like maybe the football players union or whatever, where they pamper them and put up with all the garbage and dope.
Well, that's not really a union. That you know, in my opinion, the football players union is essentially a cartel of sorts. It's Well, I don't know. I shouldn't say that. I don't know that much about it. I'm not a big football fan, so I'll just back off from criticizing them specifically.
Right, but I'm saying most people paint all unions with the same brush, and that's not fair.
Yeah,
it's not fair. I belong to a union. When I didn't work, I didn't get paid.
Yeah. Well,
I've been a member of AFL-CIO for 50 years now, and because I've been retired, I'm 80 years old.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot, and presidents, and to me, again,
And if you have a pension, and if you have good health benefits, and if you have a decent retirement, it's because you were a member of a union.
Exactly. That's what people need to understand.
Yeah, for sure.
The robber barons will give you nothing unless you fight for it.
There you go. Well said. Joe, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
And thanks
I shall. And thanks for listening to us there on WTWK. Scott, Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hey, you know, when it comes to W, whenever he speaks, I have this little mantra that helps me, cut through it all, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And basically it's, I know you think you understood what I said, but what you heard is not what I meant. and that seems to work it out pretty well.
Yes.
I think you're right. We are being set up, you know, with this hoopla regarding Jerry Ford and his passing. The big thing has been healed the nation. You know,
yes.
Every third word phrase is healed the nation.
And wasn't he decent? And Jerry Ford was a decent guy, but his pardoning of Nixon was not a decent act, in my opinion.
Well, I think you hit it on the nail on the head, saying that, you know, this is just kind of laying the groundwork in our minds for pardoning activity by W.
Yeah. Whether it's Scooter Libby or whether it's Dick Cheney who gets pardoned.
Well, and it's under the guise of healing the nation, which to me is like practicing medicine without a license. You know.
Yeah, there's a subtext to this as well, and that is the message to Congress, which is what, you know, an earlier caller was talking about, some members of Congress saying, oh, well, we shouldn't like go out and get revenge against the Republicans. We shouldn't actually prosecute them for crimes they committed. After all, that wouldn't heal the nation, and we need healing right now. No, I think that we need some justice right now.
Well, one hope that I hang on to is in November of 72, when Nixon trounced McGovern, nobody in their wildest dreams would have thought that by August of 74, Nixon would be gone.
Yeah.
And basically, if the Congress in their rightful oversight capacity go where the evidence and the facts take them, there's no other choice but to, you know, bring impeachment against these clowns.
Yeah, although keep in mind, during the Nixon process, we did not have a right-wing spin machine fully operating and fully functional in this country.
Yeah,
you didn't have thousands of hours of right-wing talk radio. You didn't have the right-wing capture of all of the news programs. You didn't have, you know, the entertainmentification of news.
One thing we did have was truth, and truth will out.
There you go. Well, I hope you're right, Scott. From your lips to God's ears. Good to hear from you. Thank you for calling. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, telling the truths that multinational corporations would, ultimately really rather you didn't know all about, but now you do. Welcome to activism. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you're not sure that you know what you know. Sometimes what you know is not exactly right. Sometimes it's wrong. Sometimes you don't even know you know the whole story.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible? By the way, our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment sponsored by LiberalStore.com. All things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Go check out the liberal teddy bear there now. That's LiberalStore.com. Joseph Hoffman is with us. He's with the Center for Inquiry, centerforinquiry.net. He's the current chair of CSER. Joseph Hoffman, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Tom. Nice to be with you today.
Thank you. You are suggesting that if we want to look to or be worried about a violent religious group, we should, you know, not necessarily put Islam at the top of the list.
Well, I'm arguing something like that. I mean, we've seen a lot in the last few years to make us justifiably skeptical about Islam, because if you judge people by their actions and not by their words, Islam has a pretty fair track record, wouldn't you say, of perpetrating violent actions throughout the world. But I'm trying to call attention not just to the tendency of Islam to perpetrate violence, but also the fact that most of the book religions, including Christianity and Judaism, have a long history of violence going right back to their origin. That's really what this is all about.
Why do you say the book religions? You're talking about the revealed religions as opposed to what, Buddhism?
Yeah. I mean, in the West, there's been a long tradition of calling Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and it comes to us actually from the way Muslims refer to the three traditions as the Allah al-Kitab. It means the religions of the book.
Right.
It's a little bit misleading because actually there are not just two books or one book. There are three different books, Old Testament, New Testament, and the Quran. But it's always been a sort of sign of respect in a way of sort of trying to achieve religious toleration among the three religions by showing respect for the fact that all of these three religions claim to be revealed. The problem is, of course, they reveal slightly different things in different ways. And one could even argue that the God of this religion reveals himself in so many different ways that it's a little difficult to talk about these three traditions as monotheistic.
Well, and you get into the various sects. I mean, the Catholics and the Protestants are still shooting at each other in Northern Ireland or have, you know, in the recent past, shall we say. And
yeah.
And not to mention, I mean, the in Judaism, you know, the Hasidim and the Reformed groups have rather different views of you know what the Bible is saying, and I'm sure, well, in Islam you got Sunni and Shia, you got this schism that goes all the way back to right after the death of Muhammad.
That's right. So what we're really talking about is a kind of warfare over a piece of real estate in the Middle East. It's really almost as if we have a bunch of spoiled children feuding over Grandpa's estate and, you know, who he left the house to.
Isn't it really warfare over mind space, not physical space?
That kind of thing. Unfortunately, it's the same piece of real estate. So whether we're talking about Palestine or Israel or the Holy Land, you know, choose whichever one of those designations most appeals to you. We're really talking about the same land parcel, and the way throughout history this ground, this Holy Land, has been fought over by the three legit religions who are all claiming to be the beneficiaries of revelation from the one God. So you might want to argue that monotheism does not automatically encourage the kind of peace and tolerance that a lot of contemporary Christians and Jews and some moderate Muslims are talking about today as a way to achieve peace for the future.
In his book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, Leonard Schlain suggests the hypothesis that that literacy has a direct association with monotheism and with hierarchical, male-dominated cultures, and that in fact during the era, during the, you know, roughly 600-700 years of the what's sometimes referred to as the Dark Ages in European history, when literacy was about 1%. It was illegal to be literate unless you were a member of the priest class, the Catholic priests, that basically there was very little warfare, that Europe was so stable as to be the Dark Ages, there was nothing happening, and that primarily the goddess was worshipped, and the goddess was the form of Mary. There was all this Mary worship, and that within one single generation of the widespread introduction of literacy in Europe, over a million women had been put to death as witches, and the Crusade, well, not the Crusades, the Inquisition had begun. He suggests that this may have something to do with literacy. Walter Ong wrote a book back in 1974 called Oralcy and Literacy, in which he suggested this. Actually, I think Len Schlain kind of borrowed it from him, but Schlain's book is far more readable. And then, of course, you got Rhian Eisler, who suggests that, no, it had to do with herding, that these were actually the people who wrote the Bible were the first herders, and they bonded with their animals and then killed them and ate them, and that caused this fundamental schism kind of a schizophrenia of, you know, that we love living things and yet we then kill them, and that made it easier and more convenient for people to kill. How do you account for the difference between the violence of the religions of the book on the one hand and for example, Buddhism on the other hand, which is a major world religion, has, you know, probably close to a billion, maybe more than a billion followers, and yet no war that I know of in history has ever been declared in its name?
Yeah, well, I don't want to overemphasize the pacifism that a lot of people claim for Buddhism, because as a matter of fact, there have been lots and lots of wars throughout the Far East and the Indian subcontinent fought in the name of Buddha and on behalf of the Buddhist religion. All of these were territorial. Very few of these things really have a lot to do with literacy. I mean, I know the theses that you're talking about, and I find them fascinating. I have some interest in the history of the goddess religions, but we really have to ask ourselves some basic questions about something that we do know about, and that is how Christianity began and what the first of these book religions that we're talking about, namely Judaism, was like in the first century BCE when a character like Jesus of Nazareth may have appeared on the scene in the province that the Romans always called Palestine and never called anything else. And what we do know about that is that peace movements, the kind of thing that we might associate today, let's say, with the Iraq War, peace movements and pacifistic movements simply did not exist in first century Palestine. What you do get in first century Palestine, this very, very volatile area where Jesus sort of walked and talked and did his thing, is that messianic movements were all over the place. And we know that these messianic movements were political. And we know that these messianic movements could often and usually were violent or else experienced outbreaks of violence. They were basically what we call today, in the popular language, political insurgencies.
Well, there's a different interpretation in some regards of what Jesus was doing. Peter Funk, for example, and Elaine Pagels and some of the others, you know, who look kind of Christian mystics and, yeah, and those who are reading the older books are suggesting, the Gnostic Gospels are suggesting that particularly when Jesus said, you know, if somebody slaps you on the left cheek, turn to him the right cheek also, or if somebody compels you to walk a mile, walk 2 miles with them, if somebody takes from you your cloak, give them your coat also, that each one of those, he was specifically instructing his disciples to force Romans who would try to enslave them to violate Roman anti-exploitation laws. That it was legal to slap somebody with your right hand. It was not legal to slap somebody with your left hand. It was legal to force a slave to carry something for 1 mile. If you forced them to carry it for 2 miles, you might cause them to rebel. These were all rules, laws that the Romans had to prevent rebellion. And it was legal to take a person's coat and hold it as security while they were working. But you couldn't, if you took their tunic, they were naked, and that was illegal. And so he was basically being like Gandhi, you know, with the salt and the spinning wheel. A pacifist rebel.
Yeah. I mean, I know the interpretation. There's probably something to be said for it, but this is a good example of reading a heck of a lot into texts which aren't entirely sympathetic to the view that Jesus was that clever. In fact, that particular view that you're talking about comes up against another opinion, which is that some of the things that they are citing Jesus as having said are things that Jesus never actually said. So then you get into the really difficult problem.
But you said there's no pacifist movement back then, and it was really,
well,
somebody said those things, and it was either A, they were being a pacifist, or B, they were being a passive-aggressive rebel.
Or C, which is the best explanation for me, is that these Gospels that we're talking about in which these sayings of Jesus were recorded were written 35 years after the death of Jesus, were written after the Christians had been expelled by their Jewish compadres from the synagogues of Palestine, and where the Christians had a lot to gain from looking like pacifists by telling the story in a particular way, which is to say the Jesus they end up with is not necessarily the Jesus you begin with. The Jesus you begin with, this Galilean preacher who comes out of the hill country and wanders, we think, into Jerusalem during the closing days of his life.
We have to wrap it up, Joe.
Sure. Yeah. But that's the view.
Yeah, I get it. Okay, centerforinquiry.net, the website, Joseph Hoffman, the current chair of CSER. Thanks for being with us, Joseph.
Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
I'm
truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott is with us, the chief cook and bottle washer, editor, publisher, and all things extraordinary over at VAWatchdog.org. Hey, Larry.
Just make that ordinary, all things ordinary.
I see. Okay, all things ordinary. You're a good guy. In fact, it's interesting. I noticed this is, I think this is new. Maybe I just didn't notice it before. At the top of your website, it says, the nation's number one independent veterans website. No membership, no dues, no fees, no premium content, no login needed, no personal information taken, no banner ads, no pop-ups, no cookies.
That's exactly right.
Cool.
The whole concept behind VAWatchdog.org, Tom, was that veterans need the information. It's very hard to find information, digging out what's happening on Capitol Hill, what the VA is doing, rule changes, legislative changes, and what's happening inside the VA system around the country. So when we set up the website, we said, this is going to be free, absolutely free. There's not going to be any, you're not going to have to pay, you're not going to have to give any personal information, we're not going to put tracking cookies on it. And we encourage veterans to take the information they find and pass it on. All of the pages have a little, you know, email this to a friend on it. Pass it on, spread the word, get out the information. A well-informed veteran population hopefully will be a very active veteran population, especially starting tomorrow with the 110th Congress coming in.
Indeed. And Stephen Boyer and Larry Craig toast. Who's going to replace them?
They are. As a matter of fact, Steve Boyer, our Republican friend from Indiana, is the outgoing chairman of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs. He will be replaced by Bob Filner of California, or the person we call Bob the Mouth Filner. Representative Filner is not a shrinking violet when it comes to his views about the VA, about underfunding, about the problems that have been created over the last, especially the last 6 years, with the Bush administration and the Republican majority in Congress. Filner is a breath of fresh air. He is very dedicated to veterans issues, and he is going to make an excellent, excellent chairman of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs.
Are you taking bets on how long it's going to be before Jim Nicholson says, okay, that's it, I'm out of here, I don't want to have to testify before Congress?
Well, you know, that will probably happen on the other side, and I'll tell you why here in a second. As we move over to the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, a Republican, Larry Craig of Idaho, is out, and coming in is Senator Daniel Akaka of Hawaii, who was the ranking Democratic member for a long period of time on that committee. But there's another member of the Senate committee that Jim Nicholson is absolutely afraid of. The word from Capitol Hill is that whenever he has to testify before the Senate committee, the one thing he fears more than anything else is questioning from Senator Patty Murray of Washington State.
Good on Patty Murray.
Patty Murray, and this is meant with the highest respect, is a mad dog when it comes to veterans issues. She has latched on to Nicholson so many times in the last couple of years and not let go. She confronted him time after time after time about the VA budget process, about underfunding. He deliberately misled Congress. We've got it under control, he said. We've got plenty of money. Don't worry about it. Then suddenly, the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, comes out with reports and says, that's not so. Murray is the first person to shove these into Nicholson's face and say, what does this mean, sir? You haven't been telling us the truth. And then Murray also pushed for legislation for emergency funding to help the VA out over the last couple of years. So Secretary Nicholson, our Republican appointee friend and former chairman of the Republican National Committee, who is now the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, should he stay on the next couple of years, and I fully anticipate he will, he's going to have a real rough time in the House, and an especially rough time when it comes before the Senate, because they're going to drag him in there, and they're going to make him explain.
You really think he's going to stick around? I mean, this is a guy who was a, he's from Colorado, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, he's a millionaire Republican, big-time donor.
Land developer.
Yeah, land developer. You know, he's basically got this job as hey, I'd like to do it kind of gig. I mean, it's not like he needs the paycheck or anything.
Right.
And it's not like he's trying to build a political CV. It's a status thing. He's got the status, and now it's gonna turn into some really serious hard work if he has to testify before Congress. I think he'd be on the run.
He could be on the run because he's had his eye on the governorship in Colorado, so he might want to duck out here in a year or so to make a real serious run for Colorado governor. I'm not sure, though. He's, you know, he is dedicated to the Republican Party. He is dedicated to President Bush. A president asked him to come in here 2 years ago, right about the time of the 2004 election, and he asked him to come on as Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and he is very loyal to the party. So whatever he does, it is going to be with party approval and party guidance. A loyalist, absolutely.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out. And just in 10 seconds or less, PTSD sufferers, new bad news?
Well, they found that PTSD sufferers have a greater risk of heart attack. They have examined a few thousand veterans coming out of the war zone and found that they are, as they age, they are at a greater risk for heart attack. They feel this is related to increased adrenaline in the system that just wears out the cardiovascular system. Not good news for returning vets. But hopefully the VA will be on top of it as far as treatment goes.
Yeah, a true tragedy. And another reason why we shouldn't be going off on some of these adventures that Bush is sending us on. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
For me and you.
Yeah, oddly enough, Spider-Man is thinking the same thing. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting here, the Tom Hartman Program. That's me. Oddly enough, Spider-Man. The new edition of Spider-Man is out. The Amazing Spider-Man, comic number 536. This is from Examiner.com. You can read the story over there. This is a hoot. In Marvel Comics, there's this kind of, it's called the Civil War story arc. The U.S. government passes the Superhuman Registration Act. After hundreds of innocent American men, women, and children become collateral damage in a superhero-related tragedy, the President of the United States even swings by the disaster site to assist the damage. This is the article by Jeff Dufour and Patrick Gavin. The act mandates registration of all superheroes with the government. Spider-Man initially supports the act, but then grows suspicious after discovering that unregistered captives are being held without civil rights at an offshore prison called the Negative Zone. Oh, and the prison was built with a no-bid contract. Detainees will remain there for life if they don't register. Now to the present, in this latest Spider-Man comic, America's favorite swinging web-slinger takes to New York City's airwaves to publicly denounce the act. This is, you know, the Spider-Man version of the Patriot Act. Spidey says, this is a quoting from the comic book, I've seen the very concept of justice destroyed. I've seen heroes and bad guys alike, dangerous guys, no mistake, but still born in this country for the most part, denied due process, and imprisoned potentially for the rest of their lives. But there's a point where the ends don't justify the means, if the means require us not just to give up our identities, but who and what we are as a country. Spider-Man, speaking out against the Patriot Act in Guantanamo Bay and the loss of civil liberties in the United States. Amazing. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Amy in Rockville, Maryland, you wanted to correct a bit of my use of language.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, your guest said that Jews follow the Old Testament, but actually that's not technically correct.
Christians refer to that as the Old Testament.
I'm sorry, what?
Christians refer to it as the Old Testament, right. But Jews don't.
They call it the Hebrew Bible, but it's not the same thing. It's and I'm not a rabbi, but I've learned from my rabbi that they're not the same thing. And from what I understand, the major difference has to do with the order the things are in, which gives a different context to everything.
You're talking about the Tanakh?
Right.
Versus
the Old Testament.
Yeah. Okay. And then, of course, there's the Torah, which is just part of the Tanakh, which is...
Right.
You know, or part of the...
Right. The Torah is the first five books in Moses, but there's two other parts, yeah.
Yep. Okay. Point made.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Amy. Perfect. Good to hear from you. George in Lacey, Washington, listening on WPTK, Talk 1090. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, George.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Hey, I really appreciate your program and listen to it at every opportunity. I wanted to share with you, I know that many of your listeners are interested in the whole issue of impeachment.
Yes.
And I wanted to share with you and your listeners that we here in the Olympia Lacey area in Washington, just 100 miles north of where you're broadcasting, have put together a group called that we call ourselves Citizens Movement to Impeach Bush and Cheney, and we went to the Olympia City Council in November after collecting about 2,000 signatures on a petition to endorsing impeachment with very little effort, really. We went to the Olympia City Council and requested that they support our resolution, pass it on to the to Congress, and were surprised when they granted to us the use of the premier facility in Olympia. It's the Washington Center for the Performing Arts.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that facility now for an event that we're putting together for the 20th of February, where we have invited folks that you are familiar with, Elizabeth de la Vega,
mm-hmm.
a former federal prosecutor,
yeah.
Ray McGovern.
She's been on this program. So is Ray McGovern. Yeah.
Yes, Ray McGovern and a guy named David Lindorf, who's also written extensively regarding impeachment. And we mm-hmm. wanted to invite anyone within your range of broadcast to come to that event.
It's well, I think you just did. Do you have a website for it?
Yes, we do. It is impeachbush@riseup.net.
Oh, that's an email address. So if people want more information, they should email to impeachbush@riseup.net.
They can do that, or they can actually, can I give you my phone number? They can call me.
I would not recommend that, George.
Okay, all right.
You know, just speaking from personal experience, I would not recommend that.
Okay, the event takes place on the 20th of February, mm-hmm. Tuesday,
yep.
at 512 Washington Southeast in Olympia, Washington.
Yep, no, we got it. So I thank you, George, and you know, good luck to you. And I think it's absolutely great what you're doing, and you know, I salute it. You might want to put together just, you know, if you've got somebody who can grab a URL and make it easy, you might want to try that. Alex in Scottsdale, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Tom. Again, I was getting back to our friend with the McCain Doctrine, Mr. McCain.
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Edwards. You know, this is pretty poignant in what's going on, because I don't know if McCain just completely forgot his experience in Vietnam.
More
soldiers there didn't do enough for him.
I think increasingly the reality is that McCain will do whatever it takes to get himself elected president. He'll take any position. He'll make any statement. He'll kiss any politician, including George W. Bush, in the hopes that he's going to, or allow Bush to kiss the top of his head, I guess is what happened, and in the hopes of becoming president. I think it's frankly tragic. It's a slow motion tragedy we're watching in John McCain, and it's really quite saddening, frankly.
Well, you know, here in Arizona, a lot of us believe that, you know, when they had the famous picture of him and Bush standing together on the tarmac in Air Force One, and you see Bush there with a smile, and you look at McCain like somebody had a control stick inside of a puppet, but the look on the human part of it was that, I really don't like this picture, but I'm having to do it.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know,
so you guys are willing to cut him some slack and... You know, I just, you know, there was a time a couple of years ago when I thought actually fairly highly of John McCain, but then after...
I actually used to think that, too, but, you know, after growing up in the Vietnam experience and losing a lot of friends, and I had a particular client of mine, her son was in the Coast Guard,
mm-hmm.
which is a branch of the military if people don't really know it.
Right.
And he was the only son, and I watched this kid grow up for like 19, 20 years, and he was a medic over... on one of the Coast Guard carriers.
Mm-hmm.
And because they've got a shortage of them, because there's so many wounded in Baghdad, they shifted 10 of his buddies over there. And it was 2 days before Labor Day weekend. Now, Mr. Gillespie, Anthony Gillespie, which is Kevin Gillespie's son, and I talk about this a lot, they were in Baghdad the week before Labor Day weekend, and all the medics, everybody on this helicopter, they threw an IUD in there, and it blew everybody up and killed everybody.
Ouch.
And that's when Bush, on Labor Day weekend, thanked the Coast Guard for their contribution, but he didn't have the stones to say what he was thanking them for.
Right. Well, when Bush says contribution or sacrifice, what he means is dead soldiers. I mean, that's the only sacrifice that has been called upon of this nation is the sacrifice of our military, and it's like sacrificial lambs. It's tragic.
I mean, and this was her only son. I knew the kid for 19 years because I took care of it with a client for many, many years.
Yeah.
And I found out about it. She was calling me, and she was having a problem with a particular job that we had done for her. I came back. I said, what's the real problem? She goes, Anthony's dead. He got blown up in Baghdad, and he joined the Coast Guard so he could become a marine biologist. Instead, he got sent over to Baghdad to become a statistic.
Yeah, it is so sad. Alex, thank you for the call. Jeez. Rama in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Rama.
Hey there, Tom. Long time no see.
Yeah, it's great to be back on KTRC. So what's up?
Oh, I wanted to ask you about this story that's been floating around the internet. And it's about Secretary Paulson being arrested in Germany.
Yeah, I read that yesterday, and I one of the folks in the chat room came in and said, what do you think of this? And I can't find anything that corroborates that, and I suspect that it's just a myth, tragically.
I will hold the line, but I can tell you
that Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org is the website, and the brother of Ellen Ratner, who's the president of Talk Radio News, who does a report on our program pretty much every day. Michael Ratner has filed charges in Germany against Don Rumsfeld as a war criminal, and so we'll see how that all shakes out. Prez in San Francisco, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Prez.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
Good. I'm great.
Excellent. I was going to talk about the Christian thing, but I mainly wanted to talk about the 7 or 8 day long ordeal of deification for Gerald Ford, as you did for Reagan. Maybe not as bad.
Yeah, well, I think that this is all, they're pumping this whole thing. Obviously, feel good about Republicans, but even more important, feel good about people who pardon other people.
Exactly. And I woke up this morning, I almost started crying thinking about that coffin. And if we had to see even 10% of the coffins coming back, what a change that would make.
Yeah, I agree.
But also, I noticed before I could get up on the, I work in a hospital, and one of my patients had this thing on yesterday, and before I got a chance to turn down his voice, I heard W say this phrase, Gerald Ford volunteered for combat. And I couldn't believe the shamelessness and just drumbeat he managed to insert that into this funeral service.
Yeah, Bush, who was AWOL during the Vietnam War.
Oh, completely. Yeah, they offered a reward for anybody that saw him in Alabama. Nobody's claiming.
Oh, I know. It's a $10,000 reward.
Exactly.
It's still out there. Prez, I got to run. Thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. Time now for the Tom Hartman Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for the day, who was the previous owner of the Koran that Keith Ellison will use in his congressional swearing-in photo op? Sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466, gets an autographed and personalized copy of my new book, Screwed. Answer coming up right after the break.
I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels. I love coffee in a cup, little fuzzy pups, old TV shows, and snow.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. Congratulations to the winner of our progressive pop quiz. Our question once again was, who was the previous owner of the Koran that Keith Ellison will use, the newly elected congressman from Minnesota, or is it Wisconsin? One or the other. Minnesota, I think. Will use in his congressional swearing-in photo op. And congratulations to Lisa Lawrence in Burien, Washington. Congratulations, Lisa. She knew that the correct answer. Now, get this. Let me just set this up. The irony of this. You got Mr. Goody, the congressman who represents the county in which Thomas Jefferson was born, out there attacking Keith Ellison for being a Muslim and saying we've got to do things to prevent more Muslims from getting elected to Congress. And the guy who owned the Koran that Keith Ellison is going to put his hand on for the photo that they take when he gets, after he gets sworn in, because when he actually gets sworn in, there's no Bibles or anything. It's just, you just raise your hand and say, yeah, I do, or whatever. But when he does the photo op, the previous owner of that Koran, Thomas Jefferson. And good on you, Lisa, for knowing the answer. Irony is not dead. Man plans and God laughs or something like that. Anyhow, let's take a quick look at what's going on with the U.S. occupation the ongoing U.S. occupation in Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight and to die. And there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire.
Developments following our security developments in Iraq as of 10:15 GMT on Wednesday via Reuters. Dateline Baghdad, the Central Criminal Court of Iraq convicted 48 security detainees between December 8th and the 28th for various crimes including murder, kidnapping, and illegal possession of weapons. They sentenced a Syrian, a Saudi, and a Sudanese man to death in connection with terrorist acts. In Kirkuk, the corpse of a man was found shot dead and tortured in that oil-rich city. In Baghdad, a car bomb near an intersection wounded one person in the Mansour district in west-central Baghdad. In Ramadi, U.S. forces conducted a string of raids in that city, the capital of Iraq's restive western province of Anbar, and detained 23 suspects. And in Baghdad, a roadside bomb killed a U.S. soldier when it exploded near his patrol south of Baghdad on Sunday. We are now well over 3,000 Americans dead in Iraq. Not to mention 600,000 or more Iraqis dead, dying at the rate of over 1,000 a month. In Baghdad also, the Iraqi government, what's the source of this? The Associated Press. The Iraqi government on Monday ordered the closure of a Baghdad office of a Dubai-based television station whose newscaster wore black mourning clothes while reporting on the hanging of Saddam Hussein. A spokesman for the Interior Ministry said the Al-Sharqiya station, owned by a former chief of radio and television for Saddam, had incited violence and hatred in its coverage and had ignored warnings to stop. I'll tell you, this hanging and taunting of Saddam Hussein, had Saddam Hussein had a trial in an international venue like the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and had his crimes been laid out for the world to see, and had he had a chance to properly and appropriately defend himself the way Slobodan Milosevic, for example, did in The Hague, or the way that the Nazi war criminals did in the Nuremberg tribunals, had it happened that way, in a clear and open and absolutely transparent fashion, and then he had been, well, had it been The Hague, he simply would have been sentenced to life in prison. Had it been the Nuremberg trials, he probably would have gotten a death penalty. But for actual crimes against humanity, I mean, they didn't prosecute the really serious stuff, the gassings, for example. Why? Well, because Don Rumsfeld sold him the gas, and we didn't want that to come out. Had that happened, though, in a truly transparent fashion and been conducted in a way that accorded dignity, not to Saddam Hussein, but to the concept of the rule of law. I mean, that's the important point here that so many people who are just trying to play politics or gotcha with this thing miss. Then, frankly, I don't think even the Sunnis in Iraq would be all bent out of shape. Military Times, by the way, polled their readers, active duty subscribers, to their papers and found, surprise, surprise, only 38% of active duty military support an escalation of the military efforts, the occupation of Iraq. Only 35% approve of Bush's handling of the war. A majority disapprove. Only 41% think the U.S. should have gone to Iraq in the first place. And then finally, as they note over at Crooks and Liars, here's this amazing bit. In the three previous polls, nearly 60% of the respondents identified themselves as Republicans, double the population. In this year's poll, only 46% said they're Republicans. Yeah. Coming up tomorrow, top news of the day. Plus, conservative Yaron Brook and I will be debating fast food chains serving children's hospitals. And Greg Palast is going to be here on New Orleans, Big Easy to Big Empty. Some research he's been doing for the BBC. That and your calls on the Tom Hartman program. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Take good care.
The
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.